Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Longtime Utah Valley President, University President Astrid Tumenez is stepping down. And Washington County rejects Utah's new court-approved congressional map. Also, 13 Utah lawmakers will not seek re-election in 2026, but nearly every open seat is contested. Joining me today on the program are Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Tom.
Good morning. Reporter Brooke Larson is with us. Brooke, thanks.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern is with us. Emily, thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Let's start with Courtney. So this is was not expected, I think. It was a speech that President Tumenez gave, and she announced she's stepping down.
That's right. Yeah, she gives an annual State of the University address. A lot of university presidents do. It's kind of like the governor's State of the State or the president's State of the Union. So she gave a State of the University address, and you know, it's this hour-long speech. And then at the end, she announces that she's leaving the university.
Now, as a part of the speech, and apparently this is something she does, she danced, right? She's known for her spunk. That's one thing.
She is definitely known for her spunk. Yeah, she danced. There was a moment where her presentation actually went offline, and so she just had him turn Bruce Springsteen on the speakers, and she just danced on the stage until they got the presentation back up.
Now, this past year has been incredibly difficult for President Tumenez, both professionally and personally. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it was definitely a rough year for her, and she talked to the Tribune about that in a Q&A at the end of the fall last year. But basically, you know, she had she'd lost her husband in February of last year, and then a couple months later in September, the Charlie Kirk shooting happened on UVU's campus on actually the birthday of her husband. So she had been leaving the country to kind of commemorate her husband, you know, on a trip. And then got news of the Kirk shooting and flew back to Utah to respond to that.
Of course, I think she instituted a review of the security. Some folks are saying that the small security force at UVU wasn't sufficient for the Charlie Kirk event.
There's definitely been some criticism in the fallout of how Utah Valley University handled the shooting. It does have a really small police force. Part of that is because UVU doesn't have campus dorms. It doesn't have any live-in facilities, essentially, on its campus. So it has a smaller police force than, say, like the University of Utah, which has a lot of dorms. But essentially, the criticisms are that UVU's police force didn't really prepare well enough for Charlie Kirk to come, didn't really think that the audience was going to be as big as it was, so kind of underestimated that, and then, just didn't essentially have the adequate security preparations, you know, a threat assessment ahead of time.
Now, President Tumenez, in the wake of that shooting, she instituted some events on campus, trying to bring people together, I believe.
Yeah, she definitely has shepherded the school and the community in the aftermath of this. She organized extra security kind of immediately afterward. She hosted a campus vigil for folks. One of the big things that she did was open therapy. So anyone that was at Charlie Kirk's event and witness to that was able to go to therapy at Utah Valley University to kind of seek support for that trauma. And she's also spoken publicly about her own therapy that she's gone through, you know, in the loss of her husband and with this second trauma that happened. She's been very open about mental health.
So tell me about some of her goals. She right now she's the longest serving president in Utah, right? So she had some goals, I think, coming in. How did she do?
Yeah, I mean, she blew past every goal that she set, which is pretty extraordinary. So by the time she steps down on May 1st, she'll speak at commencement, and that'll be basically her last event as president. She will have served for 7 years and some change, about 8 months, I think, if I'm doing the math right. So about 8 years total. But when she started in 2018, she had set these goals to grow enrollment and to increase the graduation rate at the school, and just extraordinarily surpassed those. So when she started in 2018, enrollment at UVU was 39,000. It was already the biggest school in the state, and it still is, but now it's at almost 49,000. So about a 10,000 jump in students there. And then she wanted more than 40% of students to essentially be completing their degrees in 6 years, which is the standard metric that the schools use for degree completion. When she started, 35% of students were completing their degrees in that time frame. And then this past, well, I guess it's spring 2024 because that's the latest we have the numbers for, but 46% were graduating that time frame. So an 11 percentage point gain, which is pretty much unheard of in higher education.
Yeah, that's a lot of growth. And as you write in your story, UVU, they're putting up a building every year or something. It's a lot of growth.
Yeah, she personally has overseen more than 10 buildings opening on campus in about 7 years. So yeah, almost more than a building a year. It's truly huge. I mean, they built a very large bridge over I-15 in Utah County so the students could get to campus. I mean, it just is huge. And then there's this additional campus they want to build in Vineyard that would be health focused. They've got more than 200 acres there, so just massive expansion.
Now, she did mention cost. She wanted to keep the cost down, low barriers for entry. Of course, it's open enrollment. They did have to increase costs somewhat, I think.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm glad you mentioned that UVU is open enrollment. So there's no GPA or test score essentially required for students to come in. And President Tumines has been very adamant about keeping that standard. She wants education to be accessible and open to everybody. But yeah, at the same time, you want education to be open and you want it to be affordable. And it has remained fairly affordable, but there has been some increases in tuition that she said were necessary to basically accommodate for all of this growth. So it's still, I mean, there's eight public colleges and universities in the state, and it is fifth cheapest out of those. So it's still relatively very affordable. It's less than $7,000 a year for tuition and fees.
This idea of open enrollment, everybody has a chance to higher education. That's very personal to her, right? She's just tell me a bit about her background.
Yeah, she has a really stirring story. She shared it often, talking about how she basically got into education and how it changed her life. And that started when she was a kid in the Philippines. When she was 5 years old, some Catholic nuns came into her town in the slums in the Philippines and offered some seats to her and her sisters to go to school in the community. They went and they had scholarships to go, which was part of why they were able to. And President Tumines has just talked about how, she took advantage of that opportunity in every way. I mean, she has joked that she'd read everything she possibly could, cereal boxes she found on the streets and Nancy Drew books that were at her school. And she talks about starting life basically as a statistic that she didn't think that she would go anywhere from that, poverty lifestyle to where she is today is the president of a university. And not to mention, I mean, all of the work that she's done in between that, with Microsoft and with global peace conflict with Russia. I mean, she truly has had a pretty extraordinary life.
I think she was, student body president or something at BYU.
Valedictorian, yeah.
Valedictorian at BYU. Then went to, was it Harvard and MIT?
Harvard and MIT, yeah. So
Yeah.
really a huge trajectory. One fun fact about her time at MIT is that she was defending her dissertation for her PhD and was 7 months pregnant with her first baby. And so she always jokes that she told the committee, like, you better pass me or I'm just gonna like pop this baby out and you're gonna have to deal with that. So
Now, she was a very surprising choice. She's working for Microsoft, I think, at the time. She'd never been a department head, never been a dean.
right. So yeah, she didn't have a ton of higher education experiences coming into this. She had worked at one school in Singapore. And so she was an assistant dean there and a vice dean of research. And so not really a what you would see as a traditional trajectory into higher education. So she, was only there for about 4 years, but yeah, was working as a regional director for Microsoft. And so yeah, just came from basically the corporate sector into higher education, which is not something that we see often in Utah higher education, at least.
So, a lot of positives, of course. So, a lot of fans. There are some critics, right? And some controversies during her time.
Yeah, and not a, I wouldn't say a ton of controversies compared to some of the others that we've had at the public universities in the state. But every president has to make difficult decisions, and so a couple of those are that she closed down an English language program for students who don't speak English as their first language at UVU, and that caused some stir. She basically said studies show that if those students are just integrated into a traditional classroom, that they do better, but there was some pushback. And then probably the bigger one is in 2021, she chose Wendy Watson Nelson as the commencement speaker at UVU. Nelson is the wife or the widow of the late Russell M. Nelson, who was the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. But Nelson had some of her own essentially works that were controversial that talked about the LGBT community and gay relationships and some words that students found hurtful that she used there. And so there was some protests that she was chosen as the commencement speaker.
So now two vacancies, right? Weber State University and Utah Valley University. It's interesting, Utah System of Higher Education announced a new model that they're going to use with starting with UVU.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned those vacancies too. I keep thinking that the turnover in higher education leadership is going to stop, and then it doesn't. It's been about 8 years of just kind of constant turnover. But yeah, I think that the new model that's going forward is going to be really interesting. So the Utah System of Higher Education is going to appoint basically a full transition team. So it'll be like UVU and higher education officials on this team. I'm not sure how many people it will be yet, but they'll basically help lead the school in the interim. And then once a new president is chosen, they'll actually be in place for the first 6 months of that person's tenure too, just to help make sure that it's a smooth transition, that new person has the support that they need. It's what companies in the private sector do, so it's not necessarily unheard of. It just hasn't really been put into public education.
President Tumenez, what's she going to do next? Has she talked about that?
She said she's not sure yet, which is actually kind of interesting. I think, as we talked about, she's just had this very, very tough year and just needs some time to take a breath. She said she doesn't know where she's going to be next, but she actually kind of sees that as a good thing. A little bit of a leap in the dark is what she called it. She definitely is also going to spend some time with her family, which she talked about in her speech a little bit. Her kids, she has three children. They've grown up while she's been in this position. Her youngest son was 8 years old when she started, and he's now 16 and driving. And so, she's seen her kids essentially just grow up in front of her eyes and wants to just spend some time with them too.
Thanks for telling us about this. We have a couple of minutes left. I'd like to move to another president. This is the president of Salt Lake Community College. Did a bit of a profile of him. Here's the headline: in anti-DEI Utah, this college president is gay, Latter-day Saint, and a first-generation student. He's not shy about it. This is Greg Peterson. So tell me just a bit about him.
Yeah, it was a real joy to sit down with Greg Peterson. He's just a very warm individual, and he talked just about his own identity and how he uses that to connect with students, and basically to show them like your identity is an asset, and no matter what your identity is, you can basically end up in any position you want. You can be the college president if you want. And so he just shared a little bit about his own life, and it was a really beautiful interview.
So he did a Q&A at in Circle, an in Circle event. Very interesting to have read your reporting on this. He talked about being a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints and coming out as gay, which a little later in his life he did that, and trying to reconcile those two. Tell me just briefly about what his thoughts on that.
Yeah, he turned 50 this month, and he came out as gay when he was 38, so about 12 years ago. And he talked at In Circle, which is an LGBTQ community support group. He went to one of their homes in Provo and talked to students at Brigham Young University, which, as we know, is sponsored by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and where Greg Peterson also did his undergraduate degree. And he just talked about how he basically came to terms with being gay and Latter-day Saint, which he had seen as a conflict. The church doesn't exclude members who are gay, but it does say that they can't engage in same-sex relationships and remain in good standing. And so he just talked about how he was able to kind of divide his sexuality and his faith into two different ways of viewing the world, and how he basically reconciled those and talked to BYU students about, if they're going through the same thing, this is what I'd advise.
One more brief thing on this. Of course, we know about HB 261. The legislature mandated anything DUI should be eliminated from universities. You write that he tried to keep open their gender and sexuality student resource center, wasn't really able to in the face of HB 261.
Yeah, it's an interesting part of all of this too. Salt Lake Community College had this gender and sexuality student resource center, and it had kept it open and tried to basically open resources to all students, which was the requirement under this DEI law that passed, was that if you had any kind of specialized services that catered to a specific identity, you had to open them to all students. And so Salt Lake Community College tried to do that. It started offering services for like married students, of any orientation at its resource center. But the Utah System of Higher Education did an audit basically of how schools were complying with the anti-DEI law and just found that the center wasn't in compliance. And so Salt Lake Community College moved in December to shut it down. It affected a lot of students that said that they had found a home and a safe space at that resource center. And I think, President Peterson would say too that, it was a center that he had wanted to keep open and just, wasn't able to.
We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Courtney Tanner. Thank you so much for telling us about these two stories.
Thanks for having me,
Thank
Tom.
you. We'll have you on a little later with Underplayed Stories. We're going to head toward a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. Following the break, we're going to be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Here's the headline: Washington County rejects Utah's new court-approved congressional map. We'll talk about that following a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in now Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you. Interesting story here. Of course, we've been talking a lot on this program about the congressional maps and all that back and forth. Now you have a story about how Washington County is responding to this. The actual headline is, "I'd like to be out of compliance. Washington County rejects Utah's new court-approved congressional map." And that's a quote, "I'd like to be out of compliance," from one of the county commissioners, I believe.
Yep. That was County Commissioner Victor Iverson. This happened at a county commission meeting last month. And in December, the county commission voted against amending its code to adopt this new map that was, from this ruling that you mentioned by Judge Gibson.
The commissioner, obviously, very opposed to the judge's ruling, says, "I'd like to see her come down and enforce it here in Washington County," is what he's saying.
Yeah, the meeting definitely got heated. Some back and forth between the county commissioners and their deputy attorney, just questioning the legal consequences of this. I mean, ultimately, the lieutenant governor's office told the Tribune that this decision will have no bearing on their ability to administer the election this year. And, during that meeting, the county's deputy clerk basically said a similar thing to the commissioners that, the county ballots will still likely list candidates for the third congressional district. And Commissioner Iverson said himself that this is more of a principled fight.
I guess Washington County is supposed to, ideally, they would change their code to reflect the new district that they're in. They're refusing to do this. Lieutenant Governor's office, as you say, is saying that it's really going to have no effect, right?
Yeah, that's what they said in the statement. We asked if there would be, any consequences for the county or if they would take any measures, to kind of enforce this. And that was all they said back to us. And the county commissioners have said they don't expect to have legal consequences, but we'll see how this continues to evolve.
It sounds like quite the meeting. The deputy county attorney said, "I'm just giving you legal advice," and apparently the commissioner's rolling his eyes. She knows that. What is she saying? I guess she's saying, "Well, since the judge ruled this way, this is the law right now."
I mean, she basically is explaining the legal situation to these commissioners, and they kind of kept pushing back, questioning, well, is this state law or the court's ruling? And she points out that the judge's order is state law. That this statute was altered based on a vote by the people under the Constitution, that has been upheld. So she is sort of walking through, what other reporters of the Tribune have excellently been covering, the past few years, this long legal saga we've seen over this. So yeah, it definitely got contentious, as you mentioned. She points out Commissioner Iverson rolling his eyes, and just a lot of passionate things were said.
So, and Commissioner Iverson not alone in this. It seems like the other commissioner present wasn't as impassioned, but he voted with Commissioner Iverson. The other commissioner, I think you quote, saying, yeah, he agrees with all what the other two are doing. What is Commissioner Iverson saying that I think one thing he said was he believes the judge's ruling goes against the will of the people.
Yeah, so that quote that I think you're talking about, this was from Commissioner Gil Almquist, who actually
Okay.
wasn't present during the meeting. We just talked with him afterwards. And so, like, he said he can't support the judge because she's ignored the will of the people. And obviously this is complicated, but as people have pointed out, the judge is affirming that this ballot initiative that was voted in by the people. So it's definitely a heated discussion for sure.
What did the Democrats down there say?
Yeah, so I mean, the head of the Washington County Democratic Party called this political grandstanding, that they don't have the authority to do what they're doing. And at the end of the day, the lieutenant governor's office is in charge of this process. And so, yeah, essentially calling this just a political move.
Yeah. Let's turn to water, another contentious issue. You went to the latest water conference. This year it was in Salt Lake, I think, right?
It was actually in Las Vegas.
Oh, in Las Vegas. Okay. You had all the water commissioners, right? All seven states, I guess, represented.
Yeah, so the Colorado River Water Users Association Conference is the biggest Colorado River conference of the year. The seven negotiators were there, and they had a final panel at the conference. But it also, I think there was around 1,700 people there in attendance, ranging from water district managers to environmental advocates and tribal leaders. So a lot of people that are working on the river and care about its future.
So it's interesting. One of the disagreements, many disagreements, obviously, right? Here's the sub headline: Is hydrology the problem? Some are saying, well, it's obvious, it's not enough water. And others are saying, no, we need to change the structure.
Yeah, so particularly the state negotiators have pointed to what is making these negotiations so difficult is that there's just less and less water in the river. The Colorado River Basin has been in drought for over 2 decades. So that, kind of creates this risk-averse mentality, in that people are willing to give up less because there's less to go around to start with. But others are also pushing back against that, and that, we have known that we are in it. We've been experiencing this drought for 2 decades. Isn't to go away. And so these negotiators, state leaders on this have had a long time to prepare and adapt, essentially. And that we can't just keep blaming the low flows in the river, that we also need to be looking at how we adapt our structures and systems to work with the realities of the river today.
So I guess right now Lake Powell is about 28% full. Is that the case?
So Lake Powell is low. We're having, record low snowpack across the Colorado River Basin. So we're looking at to have a pretty dire water year again.
So 3,490 feet is the minimum power pool. You drop below that, the water won't run the turbines. How far are we from that?
It's a little hard to say how close we're going to get to that this year at this point, just in that, we're pretty early in the winter, relatively. I think this spring we'll have a better idea, but, the Bureau of Reclamation puts out these 24-month studies that look at the most likely elevation of Lake Powell and the minimum, and, it is showing within the next year and a half that the minimum study shows that it could drop below that level. And with these kind of, the conditions with these droughts, it's been hard for scientists, water managers to predict because it's just getting drier and drier than scientists even think it will. So that minimum study in some cases is more accurate, but it's still, I would say, to be seen based on how this winter turns out.
So the states are trying to come to an agreement. What if they don't? What if they can't agree?
Yeah, so the federal government just put out last week an environmental impact statement, which is basically a really long, complicated legal document that analyzes various possible actions they could take. And there's five alternatives in there right now, and there's pretty much only one other than a no action that they currently have the legal authorities to even do. But likely, if the states don't come to an agreement, I mean, the federal government has a legal responsibility to manage these reservoirs, so they have to determine some sort of action. And Scott Cameron, the acting commissioner of the Bureau of Reclamation, told me that, they will choose one of these alternatives themselves if the states can't come to a deal.
So the Upper Basin states, that's Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Wyoming, seems like they've always been at odds with the Lower Basin states, right? Arizona, California, Nevada. I hadn't remembered this till I read your story, Brooke. The Lee's Ferry is very important. That's the point. The Lower Basin states say that if the Upper Basin states don't allow an X number of water to flow past Lee's Ferry, then they're out of compliance.
So Lee's Ferry is the dividing line between the upper and lower basin, and that's just below Glen Canyon Dam. And under the Colorado River Compact, which is, a century-old document, it outlines how much water is supposed to flow past that each year. And we're, with these dry years, getting close to reaching this tripwire, as some Colorado River experts call it, where we'll that flow will be under the requirement. And there's disagreement. It's really kind of legally complicated, but there's, different opinions across the upper and lower Colorado River Basin if that is amount is an obligation, basically water that the upper states, including Utah, have to deliver past that point, or if it's a non-depletion. And the kind of difference there is basically the upper basin states are saying that they aren't depleting the river themselves, which, use full allocation of the river. They've used less than the lower basin states. And their argument is it's climate change, these drought conditions that's causing that lower flow, and they shouldn't be penalized for that.
You quote to the Nevada negotiator. You mentioned the first of the story. They're in Vegas. I guess this is appropriate. They drew cards to see who would go first, and the order in which they're speaking. The Nevada negotiator went last. I thought he had a great analogy.
I know, and I love that they drew cards. It was a very Vegas scene, and the Nevada negotiator drawing the ace. And yeah, he compared it. He said we're all in the same rowboat. The first one to fire a shot puts a hole in the boat and sinks it. And that does feel in some ways that the situation they're in. I mean, all of these seven states share this river. 40 million people rely on this water, including many Utahns. And ev it's, everyone stands to lose if they can't reach an agreement.
So I think there is a deadline coming up that's, I guess, that they're going to try to get a agreement by.
Yeah, so the deadline the federal government gave the states was February 14th. They were in Salt Lake City this week. That's maybe what you were thinking up top. The state negotiators were that, have been talking regularly for the past couple of years, especially this year, meeting weekly at times. And so they were in Salt Lake this week for 4 days, continuing to hash this out. And they are supposed to have an agreement by February 14th. If they reach an agreement, the federal government will basically say, put that into this big environmental analysis that they're doing right now as their preferred path forward. If they don't, that opens a really complicated legal pathway forward.
Well, thanks for telling us about this. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Tom.
Thank you. We're going to prepare now for another break. You're listening behind the headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be talking next with Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. Here's the headline: 13 Utah lawmakers will not seek re-election in 2026, but nearly every open seat is contested. Interesting election year. We'll talk about it following the break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in now Salt Lake Tribune State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Thank you. I want to talk about the reelection campaigns. 13 Utah lawmakers will not seek reelection. But first, Emily, we're talking with Brooke about the redistricting, how it's going over in Washington County. You and Robert Gerkeman keeping an eye on how the Utah Republican Party is doing in gathering signatures. So, first of all, I guess what would, if they get those signatures and this passes, what would this do, this initiative?
So essentially, what the initiative aims to do is repeal the voter initiative that was passed in 2018. That essentially, District Judge Diana Gibson's ruling is based on that that is requiring these new congressional maps going into November. So, Republicans are trying to essentially say, well, the judge ruled that we have to listen to this voter initiative. That's the ultimate law. So this effort by the Utah Republican Party is trying to ask voters again about the same law.
So under the rules that the legislators set up, the Republican Party needs just under 141,000 signatures. How are they doing?
Yeah, so Robert Gerke and I are working on an update on that a little bit later today, but they are not halfway yet, not even halfway yet, They've got quite a bit of way to go.
And what's the deadline? When do they have to have these signatures in?
See, we'll have to double check that. Robert Gerke's been the lead reporter on
Ah,
this.
right,
I'm
yeah.
helping with a lot of the visualizations for him.
Okay, great. Yeah, I think it's coming up pretty quick here that they have to have those signatures in. So let me turn, Emily, to this story. 13 Utah lawmakers will not seek re-election in 2026, but nearly every open seat is contested. There's a lot of intra-party, Republicans running against each other this time around.
Right. Yeah, it's an interesting dynamic. Especially, this year as we're heading into a re-election for 3/4 of state lawmakers, about half of senators, all of the representatives. It's been a year that's been full of quite a bit of contention for the legislature, including around the issue you just talked about with redistricting. There was a law that the legislature passed last year that would have barred public employee unions from negotiating contracts from collective bargaining. And that was one that had a lot of opposition. It quickly qualified to be a referendum in 2026, but lawmakers came together at the end of the year to repeal that law to avoid having that referendum next to their names on the ballot. There's been, a number of as lawmakers do most year, there's been a number of culture war issues they've taken on that have been protested. And so it's been a year where there's been a lot of conflict between partisan conflict, but also with how Republicans have approached some of these issues. There's been some intra-party conflict, whether there are individuals thinking lawmakers haven't gone far enough or have gone too far, whether they think that some lawmakers are representing special interests more than constituents. And in some instances, there's been criticism of individual lawmakers for their actions that some members of the public have seen as benefiting themselves.
So who are some of the big names who are getting a primary challenge?
One of the biggest ones is the top senator, Senate President Stuart Adams. And he faced a bit of controversy earlier this year after my colleague Robert Gerke reported that he had initiated a change to a Utah law that helped a relative who was facing child rape charges, and it helped that relative avoid having a longer prison sentence and kept them from being put on the sex offender registry. And that's something he denied having acted inappropriately. But that is something he faced a lot of criticism for, including criticism from within his party and to the right of him. There's another established state senator, Senator Dan McKay, who's been in the legislature since 2012 and in the Senate since 2019, who is facing a challenge from a freshman Republican representative. And then there's also a state representative who has spent a few sessions in the legislature now, but he has developed a reputation as a so-called culture warrior who has brought forth a lot of controversial pieces of legislation and said a lot of things, even since before he was in office, attacking members of the LGBTQ plus community, attacking women, people of color. He ran a bill last year that got a lot of attention that banned pride flags on government property. So he's someone who's attracted a lot of controversy, and he's seeing a challenge from, so he is in Layton in Davis County, and he's seeing a challenge from a Davis County commissioner. And so, it'll be interesting to see how voters respond to that.
Interesting, you note that the longest serving legislator, at least at the time, Haven Barlow, his grandson's now running.
Right. Yeah, his son is currently representing. His son's from Fruit Heights. He's currently in the legislature. That's Representative Stuart Barlow, and he's announced he'll retire. He's not going to seek re-election. And one of the candidates who's in the running to take his spot is his son, Sam Barlow.
Yeah. I note that former president of Weber State University, Senator Ann Milner, is stepping down. Who's filing to replace her?
So a representative from a district within Senator Milner's Senate district, Representative Jill Coford, last session was her first in the legislature, but she is running to take Senator Milner's spot. And that leaves Senator Coford's district open, which will create an interesting race because that is the most purple district outside of Salt Lake County, the most competitive district for Democrats. Prior to Representative Coford holding it was held by a Democrat, Representative Rosemary Lesser. And prior to Representative Lesser was Representative Shurtleff, the late Representative Luana Shurtleff, who was a Democrat. So Representative Lesser is running for the seat again. There was a lot of investment by Republicans last election to win that seat, especially by House Speaker Mike Schultz. Who actually, that district was one of the districts that was targeted by a political action committee that was only funded by Speaker Schultz. But at the time, the funders weren't yet identified in disclosures. But it attacked Democratic lawmakers for voting against laws that imposed restrictions on transgender Utahns. And so Representative Lesser was one of those targeted, and she blames that PAC in part for her loss in that district. So she'll have another shot at getting the district. Representative Lesser is an OBGYN and oftentimes was a voice that represented a doctor's point of view, especially a doctor's point of view around reproductive health when she was in the legislature, which is with a lot of the debates that are happening right now around abortion policy, was a unique voice in the legislature at the time.
Couple of historic legislators are retiring. The state's longest-serving female lawmaker and Utah's first black female legislator.
Yeah, so Representative Sandra Hollins, the state's first black female legislator. She's actually already stepped down, and Teacher of the Year John Arthur has taken her place as representative. So we'll see him next week in his first legislative session. And then we were also seeing this will be Representative Carol Spackman Moss's final session in the legislature. She's, as you said, the longest serving lawmaker. And there'll be an interesting race to replace her. You've got a couple of individuals who have some political experience. The member of the Granite School Board, the Granite School District Board of Education, Julie Jackson, and also a woman named Erin Jemison, who is often seen at the Capitol. She is the public policy director for the Utah Domestic Violence Coalition. So she's often there advocating for laws that would help protect victims of domestic violence, but also advocating against laws that could reduce the resources that those individuals have access to, or that can make it difficult, more difficult for them to be safe, to get into a safe place.
Representative Matt Gwin is retiring. That wouldn't be as noteworthy, except he's recruited a big name to try to replace him.
Right. This is a name that I think surprised a lot of people. It's former Congressman Rob Bishop. Would be stepping back into politics, but on the state legislative level. So that he seems to have a pretty good shot at the seat. It will be interesting to see what a state legislative race looks like after, he previously ran congressional campaigns. Yeah, quite a surprise when it comes to candidate filings.
Several other big names to watch. You'll go and read the story, but I just want to mention this one at the end. Senator Daniel Thatcher used to be a Republican, and then he very famously changed parties. Now he's leaving the legislature.
Right, and he announced last year that he'd be stepping down, and because he left the Republican Party at the end of last legislative session and instead joined the Utah Forward Party, the Utah Forward Party got to pick his replacement for this upcoming session. So they picked Representative Emily Buss to take his spot. This will be her first session in the legislature. And it's pretty rare, I will say, for Utah to have third party lawmakers in the legislature. Emily Buss will just be the third after Daniel Thatcher. So it will we'll have an election this upcoming November in which we will see if voters re-elect Senator Buss or if they instead go with a Republican or a Democrat. And there are a couple of big name Republicans who are running against her, including former State Representative John Notwell and the former chair of the Tooele County Republican Party, Chris Sloan. So that will be quite an interesting race in November.
Well, Emily Anderson Stern, thank you for telling us about all this.
Thanks, Tom.
Appreciate it. By the way, I looked it up. The Utah Republican Party has until February 14th to gather all those signatures to repeal Prop 4. So they got to put a pedal to the metal less than halfway there, and the deadline's coming right up. Let's turn to the underplayed stories of the week. Let's start with Courtney Tanner. What's your underplayed story?
Tamara Kemsley has this really fascinating story about how President Donald Trump's travel ban on folks from Tonga actually affects students at Brigham Young University of Hawaii, where a lot of those enrolled are from Tonga. So,
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, find that at sltrib.com. Brooke Larson, what's your underplayed story?
Aaliyah Larson did a great roundup of the water bills to wash during Utah's legislative session. So I recommend taking a look at that before the session starts next week.
All right, it starts on Tuesday, of course. Sltrib.com for that. Emily Anderson Stern, what's your underplayed story?
I also am highlighting a story from Leah Larson and my colleague Addie Baird about Utah's efforts to attract data centers, largely AI data centers, and what impact that could have on the state's water supply. As Brooke highlighted earlier, the water supply is a huge problem in Utah. So there's been a lot of questions around that.
Yeah, interesting story. Find that at sltrib.com as well. Well, you've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. We've been talking today with reporter Courtney Tanner. Courtney, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you. We've been talking with reporter Brooke Larson as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. And State Watch reporter Emily Anderson Stern's been with us. Emily, thank you.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening. Hope you'll be with me next time.